Мост или подводный тоннель? В Крыму представили
строительство моста через Керченский пролив.
Были также видные представители Солнцевской и Кунцевской группировок.
Николай Батин. Грязные русские деньги. Деньги Солнцевской преступной группировки.
Вооруженные спецназовцы ворвались в зал одного из столичных кафе как раз в тот момент, когда 20
криминальных... A multi-million dollar project is announced to construct a bridge across the Kerch Strait. Police raid a meeting of Georgian gangsters at a swanky downtown Moscow restaurant. And an emissary from the powerful Solntsev crime syndicate is dispatched to Simferopol. What do all these things have in common? They're all elements of a shadowy struggle among organized crime groups to get their claws into Crimea. Vladimir Putin's annexation of Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula has turned the international order on its ear. And it also promises to upend the delicate balance in the post-Soviet underworld, with possibly violent results. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Gagliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services and post-Soviet organized crime, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And joining me in the studio here in Prague is Mirkat Sharapjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Welcome, Mirkat.
Hi, thank you for having me here today.
Glad to have you always. It's 2 weeks in a row now, and you'll probably be back next week too, I think. Well, credit where credit is due. Mark, it's all your fault we're discussing these themes this week. You wrote some interesting material on this topic this week. And in a lot of ways, it seems inevitable, with Crimea becoming the most lucrative opportunity for post-Soviet gangsters since the Sochi Olympics a few months ago, that the peninsula would eventually become a battleground. We got the $5.5 billion Kerch Strait Bridge project. There are plans to build a new casino and luxury resort and other major construction projects. Crimea's de facto prime minister, Sergei Aksyonov, is a, by according to press reports, is a mid-level gangster known as the Goblin with the Salem criminal group. And then, of course, there's the port of Sevastopol and all the lucrative criminal opportunities that has with it. As I noted in the intro, and as you wrote this week, Mark, Moscow's powerful Solntsevo gang appears to want in on the action. And Russian law enforcement recently sent a not-so-subtle message to Georgian criminal gangs to keep their mitts off of Crimea. So set the table for us, Mark. What are we looking at in Crimea as far as organized crime goes, and where may it lead?
Well, it'll probably surprise you to know that organized crime has a deep pedigree in the region. But then again, there are few parts of post-Soviet Eurasia where that couldn't be said. But it's always been an interesting situation in that, I mean, Crimea historically has had an underworld which has been quite important, even if it tends to be overshadowed by the port of Odessa, which is very much a sort of a real hub for smuggling operations all around the Black Sea. But in Crimea, for various reasons, we saw a particularly strong connection between gangs and the political and economic elite. What had happened is, as Ukraine, independent Ukraine, embarked on its frankly rather abortive state-building project through the 1990s and beyond, Crimea was never particularly effectively brought to heel. And instead, you had the rise of local circles who essentially were trying to create implicit autonomy ahead of the real one. And what we saw was the usual street gangs arose in the 1990s, particularly two ones you mentioned, Salem, and also the Bashmaki. And at first, they were your classic street gangs. They were thugs and opportunists taking advantage of the breakdown in law and order and the economic opportunities of the early 1990s.
The tracksuit guys, as you like to call them.
Absolutely. Nothing really to distinguish them. And this is, again, we have to insert the sort of footnotes, but allegedly not proven in a court of law. But on the other hand, when Aksyonov tried to sue for defamation, when it was alleged, he lost that case. But anyway, this is allegedly when he precisely was actually this mid-level sort of gangster lieutenant known as Goblin. In 1996, the conflict between the two gangs really hit a peak. Spates of killings. So much so that it even forced the often rather lethargic Crimean law enforcement agencies into action. And it looked at first as if the two gangs had either basically blasted each other out of existence or, you know, been basically suppressed by law enforcement. What has since become clear is that nothing of the sort. It was just that they went through the kind of evolution that we also saw in Russia, in which, yes, low-level thugs kill each other, but higher-level businessmen thugs realize that, in fact, actually squabbling over who gets to demand protection racket for this particular kvass kiosk is not really where the money is. The money is getting involved in business, and the money is getting involved in politics. And so this is what happened. So actually, both gangs, you know, and other organized crime groupings survived, but to a large extent, they went white collar. Mm-hmm. They moved into business, they moved into politics, they moved into a series of lucrative areas, including especially actually land. Because we're going to see, you know, real pressure on land, especially as Tatars started to return to Crimea. And they, you know, a whole variety of schemes were employed to basically allow them to buy land cheaply, to sell it or rent it off lucratively. And at this point, yes, there were still the low-level tracksuit guys, but the more important ones, they put their tracksuits away, they bought themselves shiny suits, and they moved into basically becoming fully-fledged members of the local elite. And this is, for example, you know, where not just Aksyonov, but a whole generation of local legislatures, mm-hmm. frankly, sort of come from. And so this is the situation that obtained. It's that by the time the Ukrainian state essentially collapsed with Yanukovych's ouster, the people who were in charge in Crimea were already holding the reins, not just of political power, but also a lot of economic power, as well as underworld power, which obviously also translates as muscle.
Right. Now that brings us up to the annexation. Now, what kind of dynamic do we see developing now?
Well, it's really interesting because several processes are happening that all, not necessarily deliberately, but on the other hand, there must be some kind of awareness of this on Moscow's part. All of these factors are actually contributing to a further criminalization of Crimea, definitely putting the crime into Crimea. On the one hand, you've got the fact that when Moscow took over, it wanted to have as smooth and as neat a transition of power as possible, and therefore it turned to the existing elite. In other words, it turned to the gangsters turned policymakers and allowed them to basically reinvent themselves as Moscow's trusted lieutenants, including Aksyonov, but by no means limited to him. Second key factor is exactly the amount of money that is going to be sloshing into Crimea as the Russians desperately turn this into a little Potemkin Peninsula, a showcase of how wonderful being Russia can be. And again, if we've looked at all of the mega projects, these mega projects are essentially vehicles, yes, for making something happen, but at least as much they're for transferring money to buy loyalty. They're opportunities for massive industrial scale embezzlement. Mm-hmm. And therefore, these guys who actually have the power on the ground are going to make a lot of money out of it, almost certainly. And the final element, the corollary of that, is that people are starting to get interested in Crimea in wider underworld terms. You know, up to this point, let's be honest, you know, Crimea was an interesting backwater at best. Now suddenly it's at the front line of Moscow's ideological, as much as anything else, struggle with Ukraine. It is suddenly going to become transformed into if not an economic powerhouse, but certainly a sort of a breadbasket. Mm-hmm. It has the port. I mean, the port's going to be really important because Sevastopol is not just the Black Sea Fleet's base. It's also something of a smuggling hub in its own right. The Black Sea Fleet has been involved in all kinds of smuggling, as was, because of the great advantage that its supply convoys were exempt from customs inspections. So wherever we see Russian supply ships, we tend to see a lot of smuggling going on. Same happens with Kaliningrad. But now I think people are beginning to wake up to the fact that, that as Odessa might potentially be denied to the gangsters at the moment. I mean, at present, they seem to have no problem moving their smuggled fighters through Ukraine. But it's possible that things might happen, that actually the Ukrainian government might begin to see the, you know, sort of Russian gangsters as potential fifth columnists, arguably rightly, based on what we've seen in eastern Ukraine. But more to the point, you actually have the gangsters in Sevastopol, in effect, thinking, well, we can actually muscle in on this lucrative trade. Particularly, we're talking Afghan heroin as well as a lot of counterfeit goods and such. Like, an increasing share of Afghan heroin is flowing through this region. And so, like good little capitalists that they are, in effect, trying to offer better terms. They are essentially offering to be allow criminal goods to be moved through their port for a much lower cut than you have to pay through Odessa. So we're going to see conflicts there. So at the moment, you know, all of a sudden, Crimea is suddenly becoming part of a, in effect, underworld trade war with Odessa. And also, as you mentioned in the preamble, increasingly important to the big beasts of the Russian underworld. We're thinking, well, we want to get involved in this.
Now, what's Solntsev's role in this? You wrote this week about how an emissary from Solntsev was dispatched to Crimea. Dispatched by whom? Dispatched with Moscow's blessing? What's that all about?
Well, I mean, and I need to throw in the caveat that this is just based on, obviously, very fragmentary, you know, off-the-record information. But as I understand it, the Solntsev network, which is, after all, it's a network, not a gang. It's not like it's a carefully structured organization. You know, it's lots and lots of individuals who kind of, broadly speaking, work together. But I mean, one of the structures that they do have is this network of people who are essentially representatives. I mean, the Russian word is smotriashi, which is often sort of translated as overseer. And these are the people who may be they're the representative in a prison camp system, who's there to oversee Solntsev's interests, or representative in an area where Solntsev has business interests but not a local gang, whatever. So effectively, these are the sort of trusted agents and emissaries. And as I understand it, one has been sort of sent down by a group of Solntsev senior criminals who had a sit-down of their own in Moscow or close to Moscow and decided that they wanted to get involved. Now, what this does not mean is at this stage, as it were, that Solntsev is thinking about invading the Crimean underworld. What they've realized usually is it's a lot easier, cheaper, and more effective to work with locals. But so you have someone who has moved down, gone down to the Crimea, and is starting to talk to people and starting to basically build connections so that local Crimean gangs who look useful and effective can be brought into the wider Solntsev network.
And this is all happening with the Kremlin's blessing.
Well, I mean, again, it's not, I think, as if someone in the Kremlin sort of specifically says, yes, let's go for it.
Blessing.
But I think it's more that this, you know, Solntsev operates all across the country. Solntsev operates across borders. And Solntsev has strikingly few problems with Russian law enforcement. So whether you want to read into that simply a you know, strong cliché of corruption, or, you know, roof for protection from corruption, or something a little bit more purposeful, a little bit more specific, but definitely Moscow seems willing to do that. And again, it's interesting that you mentioned this raid on a sit-down of Georgian gangsters in Moscow.
I only learned about that thanks to you, but again, credit where credit is due.
We haven't seen anything comparable done to try and break up the ethnic Russian gangs when they've had meetings to talk about the Crimea.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I want to get into more of that. Mirko, what are your thoughts? Where do you see this going? It's a pretty interesting and combustible situation right now.
Well, I think the system, what we call organized crime in the former Soviet Union, has no boundaries, and I agree with that. And in this term, the question about if the Kremlin blessed them or not, to answer this question, we have to remember that there are some big sharks like Semyon Mogilevich, for instance, who has connections with Solntsev. He is a Solntsev person and has connections with people, if not in the Kremlin directly, but to some people who are close to the Kremlin. And the Kremlin, if he doesn't give a blessing, it knows that the most organized, the most structured organization with a good discipline on whom you can rely on and they can do stuff without any problems, it's organized crime. And in the 90s, it was proven. In the 90s, they even called the organized crime in the former Soviet Union the fifth power. So in one way or another way or another, the Kremlin is going to use criminal groups there.
Right.
And here, in many cases, ethnicity doesn't play a role, but in some cases it does. Why it doesn't play a role? Salem, actually, for instance, had a very strong connections with Nagorno-Karabakh and Armenia, and people there were mainly Armenians and local Jews. Aksyonov is a survivor. Many people were killed, but Salem won Bashmaki. Bashmaki, the group, was named after Viktor Bashmakov, who was actually in 1989 arrested in Transnistria, right 1 year before Transnistria announced its independence. He was selling guns and arms in big amounts there. Interesting person who was later killed in the war in Crimea between Salem and Bashmaki group, and the group was named after him.
Right.
So what I think here, what's going on here? Yes, the organized crime will be used by the Kremlin because they need it, and people understand in the Kremlin or people around Putin, they know that people like Aksyonov and people who are controlling and have been controlling Crimea for a long time. They are those who survived in those wars, and they are out. They came out of the organized crimes. Not only Aksyonov, many people who were not from that, like Konstantinov, for instance, they clearly had connections with the organized crime, because it's not possible. It was not possible to survive and control the situation in Crimea, especially if you are an official there in 90s without
organized crime,
without relying upon organized crime services.
Now, this kind of the Crimea kind of entering the big leagues of organized crime now, this happens, and Mark, you've spoken about this on previous podcasts, you've written about this. This happens at a very delicate time in the underworld, doesn't it? I mean, it comes, the kind of delicate, precarious peace that we saw was shaken by the killing of Jed Hassan in Moscow at the beginning of 2013. How combustible is this situation?
I think that it does reflect the extent to which the current status quo is a relatively fragile one. I mean, it's quite interesting, actually, that the sit-down that the police raided the Georgian gangsters, I mean, actually it had two items on its agenda. One was the Crimea, how they can get involved in it and how they'd apportion the spoils, rather prematurely thinking on that one. But the other one was precisely yet another attempt to see if they could broker some kind of a deal in this long-running feud between the gang that had been established by Jed Hassan, the so-called Tbilisi group, and the rival Kutaisi gang, right, of fellow Georgian gangster Tariel Onyani. And that's really one of the big fault lines within the Russian underworld.
This is the biggest one of the. This is really the big fault line in the post-Soviet underworld.
It's as it were. That's the biggest kind of specific gang fault line. I mean, in many ways, most of the other things are actually pressures between the gangs that are able to access the profits from Afghan heroin and those that can't. Between a rising generation of hungry gangsters and the existing sort of leaders who want to hold on to their power, those kinds of things. But absolutely, I mean, this is one of the biggest things. But the key thing is exactly that there are all these pressures coming to bear on the underworld status quo. And yes, there are a lot of forces also trying to hold Humpty Dumpty together, ranging from the state. And I'm sure that in part this raid was exactly a warning, saying, look, don't do anything that might actually jeopardize the situation, to the big gangs, particularly the Slavic gangs, and indeed the Chechen gangs, ironically, who benefit from the status quo and have more or less made it clear that whoever starts a war, they will regard as the aggressor and turn against them. But nonetheless, there's only so long that you get to dodge a bullet. If I can mix my metaphors without singularly appropriately in this context. The killing of Jed Hassan, that was one time that, one turn of the revolver, one go at Russian roulette, and ultimately the gun didn't fire that time. Likewise, previously, with the assassination of senior Russian gangster Yaponchik, there was a thought that that might trigger it, and there were some pressures, but eventually they managed to sort of tamp it down. Sochi, as you mentioned earlier, again, was one of the big honeypots that a lot of the sort of different groups were trying to get their paws into. And certainly that led to spates of killings and such like. It didn't quite lead to a gang war, in part precisely because the state was very, very clear that Sochi had to go off without a hitch. Mm. So, again, it's as with all games of Russian roulette. It's essentially that there's one bullet somewhere, And every time the revolver trigger gets pulled, the chances of that bullet firing get greater. So Crimea may or may not be the conflagration, but it certainly indicates the extent to which each of these opportunities that comes up becomes the potential source of a real serious conflict. But can I also just very briefly pick up on 2 points of Meerkat's that I think you know, were really interesting and important, and I want to say. One is, you know, he mentioned that they're kind of the existing gangs had links to Nagorno-Karabakh and Transnistria. And I think this is one of the interesting and worrying things about the region, is because also we see Ossetia and Abkhazia cropping up, and now we see Crimea and, you know, who knows, you know, quite possibly Donetsk in due course. It's all these areas where you have sometimes frozen conflicts, sometimes are, you know, essentially states that lose control and local de facto administrations that take power. Because this is linked with Meerkat, the second point of Meerkat, is exactly the people who can take power in those circumstances tend to be people who have underworld muscle. It's one of the ways in which you're actually able to benefit from that. So whenever we see this archipelago of anarchy across Eurasia, it always seems to be the gangsters and criminalized local regimes that end up benefiting from it.
Yeah, it's interesting if you look at, and we'll talk in the second half about the role that the ethnic Russian nationalists moving into the eastern Ukraine. How often Transnistria, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, Karabakh all keep coming up again and again and again. People had there seems to be like these traveling bands of mercenaries / gangsters / nationalists that keep popping up in all of these conflicts. Mark, you wrote on your blog this week that it will probably be impossible to keep the Georgians out of Crimea. What are the implications of that? I mean, this again is another turn of the revolver here in terms of potentially provoking a war. Why do you think that, and what do you think that might portend?
Well, again, I think what it comes down to is the Georgians are a powerful force within the Russian underworld. Yes. They are not, despite what the Russian Interior Ministry often likes to claim, the source of organized crime in the Russian underworld. It's still ethnic Russians who predominate. But nonetheless, you know, the Georgians, in part because exactly they are Georgian and not Russian, and thus they are slightly outsiders within the political systems, they are not as closely bought into the status quo. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't, as it were, abandoned street gang or, you know, street crime level to simply to become businessmen and so forth. And therefore, you know, they are more likely to throw their weight around and get involved in conflicts. I think that the point is that there's going to be this delicate balance. If the ethnic Russian gangs try to keep the Georgians out completely, then the Georgians have absolutely no reason to play ball. They have effectively nothing to lose. So there will have to be some kind of accommodation, and this is actually how the Russian gangs tend to work. You know, we notice the violence, the explosions of violence when they take place. They are actually the aberrations. They are cases in which the underworld mechanism is not working, because most of the time deals are struck. There's a lot of posturing. There's a lot of presenting, you know, showing your muscle, whether it's in terms of political protectors or young men with guns or whatever. But from that comes a deal. But, of course, once you do start to bring the Georgians in, inevitably then, firstly, you get disputes over the exact slices of the cake. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it means that you transfer all the other tensions and hostilities also into Crimea. And you do so with a bunch of local gangs who actually have not really been incorporated into the big networks for long. They don't necessarily understand the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. They are often, frankly, rather less sophisticated. And therefore, I think, again, the scope for someone to miscalculate, because this is that wars start from miscalculation more often than they do from plan. And again, you know, that maybe just some Crimean thinks that he can safely knife or cheat a Georgian and get away with it, and not realizing that in doing so, he's bringing to bear these great powers of the criminal underworld.
Right. So,
well, America, I quite agree with that. I mentioned already that there is no big deal difference between nationalities or ethnic groups. They are to some extent, but let's say all these thieves by law are crowned in Russia or in United Arab Emirates or in France. They are never crowned in former socialist republics. What I'm talking about is Det Hasan Usoyan. He was an ethnic Kurd, Yazid, who was born in Tbilisi, Georgia, and he was an authority in Russia. He was not only authority in Russia, he was giving advices and settling conflicts in what we call today post-Soviet space. Mm-hmm. And this structured, let's call it serious criminal authorities, serious untouchables, mm-hmm. who follow regulations, their own regulations, the structure's power.
The thieves and the code, as Mark.
They always try to find common sense and negotiate before starting killing each other. And they will try to find the way how to deal with this. And that's very important because their structures work much more effectively. Just look what happened in Kyrgyzstan recently, several months ago. Aziz Batukayev, vor v zakone, thief by law, was suddenly released. He got an early release based on documents saying that he actually he's an ethnic Chechen. Mm-hmm. The document said that he had leukemia, and that's why he has to go to be released. And then it turned out there was a fake. Uh-huh. And now they're trying to investigate who did it and how, and now going to find out what happened. Another big shark in Kyrgyzstan, Kolya Kyrgyz, or Kamshibek Kolbayev, who is included to the U.S. list of most dangerous human traffickers and wanted by the United States. He was extradited from United Arab Emirates last year. He was sentenced to five years. The majority of charges against him were dropped. And it was announced a couple of weeks ago that he's going to be released this month, in June. Why? Because every day he spent in a detention center equals to three. And this is, they found a Kyrgyz law or something.
Uh-huh.
And instead of spending like 10 or 15 years in jail, he's going to leave in less than 1 year.
Is there any coincidence that these people are getting released just as one of the biggest honeypots in the post-Soviet space is becoming on the market, so to speak?
We know that these people who are ethnic Chechens, Kyrgyz, or, you know, Armenians, they're crowned not in their own republics even. Because the Shodka, Varovskaya Shodka, the thieves by law, those authorities, they gather in Paris.
Right.
They gather somewhere in
they've gathered here in Prague.
Or in Moscow, and they are crowned there. So they always have systems how to talk to each other. And again, we mentioned Aksyonov. He is not from this system, but he is from the group, survivor from the group which was local and appeared during this messy period of the 90s when many of the traditional criminal laws were broken. The Apelsini appeared and other things.
You know. Yeah, when Vors were they'd buy your status as a Vore. Well, this America points to something I'm actually wondering about as listening to all of this. I mean, you have this kind of 90s-style group that kind of sort of went legit or went white-collar, so to speak, in Crimea. But now you have the big boys coming in, right? Is there enough to go around? Mark, what is I mean, really, I mean, this looks like these guys had this little thing all to themselves. Now, this little thing is going to get a lot more lucrative. But with that, you got some very, very big players eyeing up this peninsula. Is there enough to go around? And is that a recipe for conflict?
I mean, if we look at Sochi as an example, actually, in fairness, the gangs do sort of try and tailor their expectations to what is available. And they're also clear that these are almost invariably that the big money comes from being involved in some level in embezzlement of state assets. And there is a clear understanding that of all the gangs, the biggest gang in town is the state. And therefore it's dangerous to go beyond that. Yes, you may well be skimming money from construction, but you can't actually halt the construction, that kind of thing. And I think potentially, I mean, there is going to be a massive amount of money flowing in there.
For sure is.
Certainly, more than enough to meet the dreams of any kind of Crimean wannabe in the early years. But I think what we'll see is first of all that this will be a finite resource. Russia will not be spending open-endedly on Crimea. And therefore, one of the real sort of flashpoints is actually when the money starts to dry up. Or if, let's say, all of a sudden, things take a different place and suddenly you have the new Novorossiyan element of the Russian Federation that is demanding resources that otherwise would be going to Crimea or whatever else. Stuff always happens. It's actually when the cake starts to shrink that you really get the violence, because people get anticipate and expect a certain level. Right. So I don't think it's actually about just simply is there enough to go around, because there is going to be a lot to go around. I think it's more that all of a sudden Crimea will suddenly start getting very crowded, mm-hmm. With different criminal interests, mm-hmm. some of whom are, relatively speaking, amateurs. They have been big fish in a very little pond.
Right.
And suddenly they realize that the pond has become a sea and there are sharks in that sea. And they don't know quite how to navigate that. And there's also the fact that a lot of these sharks, continue and slightly sort of distort the metaphor, already have prior history with each other. And they bring with them all kinds of old feuds and tensions and things. And you never know when, let's say, one gang nudges another one out of access to the flow of Afghan heroin through some particular border station over in Siberia, and that actually in retaliation leads to an attempt to nudge them out of access to some flow of resources in Crimea. I think it just suddenly means all of a sudden Crimea is plugged in to not just criminal networks but, as it were, a lot of criminal politics.
And I think
there's something else that I just want to flag up. One of the, for me, alarming trends that we've been seeing of late is the renewed or sort of different way in which the Russian state is seeking to use organized crime as instruments of power. In somewhere like Crimea, it's in terms of providing a kind of ready-baked local administration that also has street power and muscle. Mm. In eastern Ukraine, we're seeing it again as organized crime gets the opportunity to call itself a militia or whatever and basically convert its underworld power into upper world power. Elsewhere in the world, we're seeing, I think, an increased interest by the Russian security apparatus in using gangsters as deniable agents and tools. So, I think just as we're seeing the criminalization of Crimea, it also, to an extent, reflects what we could almost call as a criminalization of state policy in Moscow.
Yeah, and that's a very good segue to what we're going to discuss in the second half of the program. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and shift the focus from gangsters in Crimea to the neo-Nazis among the separatists in Ukraine's east. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services and post-Soviet organized crime, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining me in the studio here in Prague is Mirha Sharapjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Of those who are currently under my command are local people. The remaining 10% are at the ratio of about 50-50 volunteers from Russia, usually with roots in this or other Ukrainian regions, while the rest are refugees from other parts of Ukraine.
That was Igor Girkin, a separatist leader in the East. The so-called People's Governor of Donetsk was a member of the ultranationalist group Russian National Unity, whose symbol bears a disturbing resemblance to the swastika. The self-styled prime minister of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic was an editor and contributor to the far-right and often anti-Semitic newspaper Zavtra. So was the unrecognized republic's so-called defense minister, who also reportedly served as a mercenary in conflicts in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Transnistria, and Chechnya.
Pavel Губарев, национал-шовинистическая организация группу газеты And as political analyst Vladimir Pribilovsky is explaining, Pavel Gubarev, Alexander Borodoy, and Igor Grikin, aka Strelkov, are just the tip of the iceberg. Among the separatist leaders and their followers in eastern Ukraine, there seems to be a disproportionate number of representatives of Russia's radical nationalist fringe. Long marginalized, these figures seem to be having their day in the sun and have become a key instrument of Kremlin foreign policy. Mark, what do you make of that? I mean, these guys, if you look at these guys, I mean, Zavtra in the 90s, remember Zavtra? I mean, it was this fringe paper read by ultra-right-wing Looney Tunes. Well, now it's actually recruiting volunteers to go to eastern Ukraine and fight. Some of the key, most public, visible public figures are contributors or have been contributors or editors to it. Russian National Unity, which I mean is a violent paramilitary group known for its attacks on ethnic minorities. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, it to me emphasizes the point that we shouldn't necessarily assume everything is part of a single unitary program, because this is the irony. Inside Russia itself, there is clearly a tension between the kind of Russian imperialism that Putin increasingly espouses and the kind of ethnic Russian chauvinism of, you know, a Russian national unity or whatever. That these are not the kind of groups who are in favor in Moscow, inside Russia's borders. Putin has very made it very clear that he's not willing to accept, let alone espouse, that kind of chauvinism. But on the other hand, we see them being used as useful idiots outside of Russia's borders. And not just, and we're not talking about a long way outside Russia's borders, but just over.
A few kilometers.
yeah. I mean, it's clear that, look, you know, Russia is looking for agents. Russia is looking for forces it can use and encourage and support. And it says something about the kind of nature of the current sort of state of identity politics within Russia itself, that there is this bubbling up of virulent, unpleasant, chauvinist groups. And it's very gladly armed them, supported them, protected them, encouraged them, sent them across the border and such like. And so they are now becoming a true force in eastern Ukraine. But that's that, and that's fine. But they do so thinking of themselves precisely as the vanguard of modern Russia, building the new modern Russian empire. However, what happens when the war is over? Mm-hmm. However the war ends? You have armed, empowered, and supported these people. You can't then necessarily expect that you can just push them right back into the fringe. Mm. And they're actually going to be a real challenge to the kind of delicate balance that Putin has been trying to maintain of drawing on the glories of Russian imperial tradition to legitimize the Kremlin's regime, while at the same time preventing the explosion of the kind of inter-ethnic tensions which really could actually undermine it quite severely.
Right. So they may have created a Frankenstein monster they can't control here. Mirko, what do you think?
Well, I think it already happened. You remember in late 90s and early 2000s, it was not possible to see anyone there in Russia being persecuted for attacking Uzbeks, Tajiks, or Jews, or whoever. Mm-hmm. In recent years, like since 2010 probably, or a bit earlier, more and more cases, reports say that a group of ultranationalists in Russia are being sentenced to 10 years, 9 mm-hmm. years. So there was like up and down. So, Putin was using this, I mean, Russian authorities were using this all the time. And also, we have to remember Zhirinovsky. Zhirinovsky is shown on TV on a regular basis, and his statements do not differ from the statements of people we're talking about right now. His statement, he was talking about his own people, the citizens of the Russian Federation. He said, we have to put barbed wire to the North Caucasus and not allow them to be here and not to allow them to give birth to their children because they're going to outnumber us. And this is going on TV. On a prime time, everybody's watching it. Nobody's going to take responsibility for his words. He just says, okay, I'm sorry, later, and this, it goes on. I think all this done, and he is allowed to say that, to keep this kind of sentiments alive among the society. Yes, there is a danger that these people who are being used now in Donetsk and Luhansk, they might come out of control, but Russia knows how to put them under control.
Well, one of the things I've noticed is that, you know, Prokhanov, I mean, the editor of Zavtra in the 90s, suddenly, I did a search on Izvestia yesterday. It goes on and on. The guy's being published in Izvestia practically every week. Izvestia, which is like the, you know, it's not an official paper, but it's pretty damn close. Yeah. Right? It's the most pro Kremlin of the so called respectable dailies. But Prokhanov is regular in there. The other person I find interesting in this situation, though, is Igor Girkin, who goes by the moniker Strelkov. Now, according to the Ukrainian authorities, he is a GRU operative, a GRU colonel. He's also very active in nationalist circles, has been in the group of people contributing to Zavtra. He's one of the most public faces of the separatists in eastern Ukraine. He's purportedly been a mercenary in Bosnia-Herzegovina, been a mercenary in Transnistria, served in some capacity in Chechnya. I don't know which conflict or exactly how. Mark, what does this say about the nexus between spooks and nationalists?
It says all kinds of interesting things, but in particular, it shows that the boundaries are often very confused. I mean, you know, if we take, let's use the nom de guerre, if we take Strelkov, I mean, if one looks at all the rumors, I mean, either he is Rambo or else he is Walter Mitty.
Right.
And you know, the truth is probably somewhere in between. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, it is clear that he is someone who is a sort of a committed nationalist who, you know, I think it's, you know, fairly clear that he is in or very closely associated with the security apparatus. I'm not entirely convinced that he's GRU, as the Ukrainians suggest, because we've also seen suggestions that he's FSB, Federal Security Service, and you don't transfer from one to the other. You know, this is not these are not two agencies that play well together. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything because the FSB, you know, has its own commando Spetsnaz units. The FSB is, you know, empowered to operate outside Russia's borders and such like. I mean, increasingly the FSB is KGB-like in its omnicapacity. You know, but so this is a guy who, on the one hand, you know, is associated with state security, and on the other hand, seems to enjoy operating outside the usual boundaries, whether it's in terms of his nationalist politics, whether it's in terms of perhaps his operations abroad. And likewise, I mean, I don't know this, and this is purely based on inference, but I find it fascinating that this is a guy who, it does seem likely he originally went into Crimea near enough on his own initiative, or else, at least, certainly not at the behest of seniors. He's been associated with, you know, sort of political and economic interests and such like. And then he then moved from Crimea to the Donetsk, and he was associated with a variety of initiatives that, frankly, were embarrassing to Moscow. You know, such as being clearly sort of linked to kidnappings, which really did not fit with Moscow's narrative. Suddenly, though, and at the same time as we've seen this mysterious Vostok battalion cropping up within the Donetsk, you know, which for my money is very much an attempt, a Moscow mobilized force there to try and bring some degree of renewed control over this anarchic situation. And suddenly we see Strelkov, firstly sort of speaking out against the need to, you know, preserve discipline, shooting looters, and coming back into the fold rather more, being less apparently this sort of maverick force. And I can't help feeling that someone at some point had a conversation with him. And more or less it was made clear that, look, you've had your fun, but it's now time, you know, what Moscow requires is something different, and we expect that of you. Bringing him back onto the reservation,
I mean,
effect.
You anticipated my question. I was going to say, is Strelkov, like, is he domesticated or is he a loose cannon? And that's what I was having trouble kind of getting my hand on. But Adai seems to be domesticated, if you can believe if I can believe what I'm reading. I had this question about Strelkov. Was he the Kremlin's man, or was he somebody they needed to have housebroken? And it's not entirely clear, or do you think he's been housebroken?
Well, I mean, for the moment at least, I think he seems to have been brought back under check. I mean, Housebroken implies a certain finality about it. I mean, I think, you know, people like Strelkov essentially do move back and forth across the boundaries. It's a little bit like, in a very different context, Victor Boot, the arms dealer, who on the one hand clearly sometimes was operating as a state agent, and at other times was just simply operating as an arms dealer. Mm. And sometimes they overlapped, and sometimes they were complementary, and sometimes they were completely different worlds. Well, likewise, I can't help feeling that, you know, again, need to include the health warning, this is just my own read, that Strelkov operates on those margins, and sometimes, you know, it's perfectly acceptable just to let him go and do his own thing, but at times you need to grab the leash of this particular dog and bring him to heel, but knowing full well that he could well start snapping and growling at any point again.
Right. What did you make of the Vostok Battalion thing? Was this a reconstituted version of the old Vostok Battalion, or is this just something that just took the name?
Again, somewhere in between. Mm. Now, I mean, I think what it was, certainly it's not just simply coincidence, even though they say, oh, no, it's just because we're in Eastern Ukraine, so of course we're calling it the Eastern Battalion. I don't buy for a minute. As near as I can tell, when the Vostok Battalion first deployed, the central core of the command staff were from the original Vostok Battalion, which after all was a GRU-backed unit of Chechen fighters under an alternative potential leader, powerful family, the Yamadayevs, who, after they participated in the 2008 Georgian War, had to be disbanded simply because Kadyrov demanded it. He wasn't willing to see Chechen forces under a political rival. But on the other hand, the GRU, while it did that, did not lose track of the individuals within it. You know, if we have to give Russian intelligence, you know, some credit, one thing they are good at is being loyal to their own. And so they found some of the fighters' positions in the regular military, others they probably placed within the sort of the shadowy private corporate security sector and so forth. And I think, you know, when they realized that they needed a sort of a force of highly experienced veteran and gung-ho throat slitters, they already had the people they could go to and sort of say, you know, we're getting the band back together. Right. But then there are lots of other people who are also involved. You know, alongside Muslim Chechens, there are Christian, you know, Ossetian volunteers. Right. There are ethnic Russians. There are people who are clearly too young to have been in the original Vostok Battalion and such like. So, you know, I think it was just a sort of a core. And the interesting thing is that having deployed it, and it's fascinating that the first operation it did was taking a militia headquarters. Right. I think really that was an entirely demonstrative political act. Just wanted to say, look, you know, we are in town. We can basically reach out anywhere and basically bring people to heel.
Right.
So you need to understand this. But the interesting thing is, from that point, they seem to have been methodically withdrawing Chechens from the unit and actually packing it with individually recruited local Ukrainians.
Yeah.
But what that means is that although the composition changes, the culture and the command structure of the unit doesn't really.
Right. No, again, credit where credit's due, Mark. You wrote on your blog before this happened, before they took over that administrative building and got the unruly separatists out so the housebroken separatists could be in. You wrote that this was the precise reason why this was happening, and literally days later, that's what happened. So, Marikat, anything you'd like to add along these?
Well, first of all, if we talk about Girkin's Strelkov and how he used, if he is a person who is fully controlled, I just want to compare him with. It's not a good comparison, but just to put a parallel between him and Eduard Limonov.
Mm.
Eduard Limonov was always opposing the Kremlin, and he was not allowed to hold his Strategy 31 march and stuff. He all of a sudden he's okay. He's shown by TV because he says that Crimea is ours, and many regions in North Kazakhstan are Russian. They have to be returned to Russia, which irritates many people in Kazakhstan, you know. And this is how it works, you know. For a long time, somebody is just saying something against Kremlin, but saying something which is very useful for Kremlin sometimes, and they just use him later. So
yeah,
this is
reemergence of Limonov.
As for Vostok, I fully agree with what Mark said, and also to rename this Vostok would be a little bit not pragmatic because everybody knows what Vostok
is. Why mess with a good brand?
Yeah. Vostok, well, people know what Vostok is, right. And they fear it. That's what all this thing is about.
Right. We're coming close to the end. I just wanted to throw one thing in here to pull us full circle and to unite the two segments of the program. We talked about the link between the spooks and the nationalists. What about the spooks, the nationalists, and the gangsters? Put it all together for us, Mark, if you could, if you would, if you want to.
No pressure. I think in this case, what's interesting is, as I mentioned before, that the whole chaos in eastern Ukraine provides a massive opportunity for those people who have some degree of local power that is generally not official power. So maybe it's they have thugs. Maybe it's that they have, you know, criminal economic interests or whatever. And all of a sudden, because the old political certainties have been swept away, the old political structures are now in question, and there is no real control over the militarization of individual groups, they can suddenly sort of pop up and start sort of becoming big men sort of in their local communities, powerful figures. And have their own private armies and whatever else. The thing is, though, that the smarter ones amongst them, I think, do realize that just simply saying, you know, what is your legitimacy? I have men with guns. It's fine to cow the locals, but it doesn't actually really sort of provide you with much in the way of long-term capacity. Mm-hmm. They need to have something. They need to actually say, well, and we are waving our guns around and taking control of local administrative buildings for a cause. Separatism is all very well, but precisely because there is no actual clear sense of the long-term aim. Is it an independent East Ukrainian state? Is it membership of Russia? Is it a federalized structure within Kiev's control? Whatever. No one really knows that. So it's much better just to go for sort of generic and ideological appeals. And clearly, extreme Russian nationalism provides them with that. It also rationalizes a tension that we've already seen between ethnic Russian gangs and Ukrainian criminal gangs. Yeah, I'm not doing this just simply because I'm a gangster out to increase my own wealth. I'm doing this because I'm a patriot, and therefore I'm driving out these local Ukrainian criminals. If that happens to mean that there are criminal businesses now free that my people will take over, well, that's a pleasing side effect. But it does legitimize all this kind of thing. And exactly because at present, it's tempting to say that there is no real ideological opposition, there is no real alternative narrative, to use the expression, in eastern Ukraine. It's basically, well, you know, what is the ideology of these aspirant movements? Well, the only people who are really articulating one at anything are the Russian chauvinists. Mm. And therefore, it simply becomes a way of basically trying to buy in to that winning power, trying to say, well, I'm one of you. Because I too believe in these various horrible things. Mm. And, you know, very, very quick final point. I mean, if one looks at Prokhanov, whose career, I mean, I remember following when he was writing about Afghanistan, in his capacity as the Nightingale of the General Staff. But one of his kind of real glory days, in its own ghastly manner, was in the period leading up to the August coup of 1991, where in many ways he was the guy who was providing an ideology that basically said, you know, we are a crumbling empire that needs to be protected with vigorous activity, and that the important thing is basically will and the capacity to act. Well, no wonder that works in eastern Ukraine at the moment, because precisely these are people who are now proving or trying to prove that they have not only the capacity to act but the will to act, and this gives them that rationale. Right. It turns them in their own eyes, and they would hope in other people's eyes, from being just local thugs into emissaries of a greater cause. Mm.
Well, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does echo. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services and post-Soviet organized crime, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And joining me here in the studio in Prague has been Mircha Shudupjan, a senior correspondent and analyst with RFERL's Central Newsroom. Thanks for the fascinating discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and very overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed or Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week on Friday the 13th. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper Noise MC.